This is Eric Hufschmid. It's October 26th, 2006. And today I have Sophia. She's the creator of that DVD, 9/11 Mysteries, that we told you all about a few weeks ago. Sophia, how are you doing tonight?
I'm very well, Eric. Thank you so much.
Well, we've been getting all sorts of comments about your video and even selling some for you. And I thought it'd be great if we could get a little background on who you are and your video and how you got into it and whatever else you've been experiencing since then. So could you give a little background? Because most people don't even know that you're a real person.
Why do people not know that I'm a real person?
Well, for one reason, there's one person, as an example, saw the video on the internet and the sound was not matching exactly to the voices, and he thought about it and comes back with this email. Aha! This is not real. Those voices are yours, and you've pretended to be that Brad person in the beginning, and you've pretended to be that woman at the end. So there are people that, you know, initially were not even sure who created it, or you know, some people thought it was me that created it. Now I suppose since you've been on a few interviews, people now realize you're a real person, but...
Well, actually, there is quite a mystery as to who made the movie, which is fine with me. That's one more 9/11 mystery. But I didn't want to bring attention to myself. I wasn't even going to put my name on the video. I wanted to just put the video out there and let it do its thing. But it was actually Brad who suggested that if I didn't create some kind of authorship, that anyone could step forward and say they made the video. And I guess I thought the better of that, and so I did put a moniker on the into the credits. And don't ask me what a moniker is. My name is Monica. Monica Smallstorm.
Smallstorm. Well, what about Brad now? Because, see, he's another mystery of 9/11 Mysteries. Could you at least give a little background for people on who the two of you are and how you met and what's your relationship?
Yes, we actually met at the Michael Moore event, and it was because of you, Eric. You see, your tendrils and tentacles are knotting up everywhere.
Well, wait a minute. If you went to a Michael Moore event, what does that have to do with me?
Well, you will remember, Eric, that after I created the little Flash movie, the three-minute thing that luckily went worldwide within a few months of our doing it. Actually, you helped to write it and helped gather some of those pictures, and then I made it with my wonderful Flash technician. We created those little cards, the little huge questions cards, and I dressed as George Bush with a rubber George Bush mask and a child's extra large size flight suit and a crash helmet, which was a child's motorcycle helmet, but it worked for a flight helmet. And I filled the flight helmet with 1,000 of those little cards, and I got into the Michael Moore event. There were 10,000 people at that event. You remember when he was traveling the country trying to get John Kerry elected? And
It was for the election, not his Fahrenheit 9/11 movie?
I believe Fahrenheit 9/11 had come out, but his mission was to work the students of the country into voting, into activism, and
Oh, so this was just before the 2004 election.
Yeah, yeah. And anyway, so I was there in my Bush outfit, and there were 10,000 people. I had 1,000 cards. So now if you do a little math, you'll know that I had a 1 in 10 chance of handing a card to Brad, who I did not know. And in fact, I did. I couldn't believe how many people were reaching out from the grandstands to me. They wanted whatever Bush was passing out. And people couldn't get enough of the cards and me, and one man actually dragged me off and spanked me hard many, many times. And I had to beg him to stop. I had to tell him, I am not Bush. Stop it.
That may not have been why he was spanking you, though. But
oh, well, it was actually not pleasant.
But what was Brad doing here? Brad, I thought he was Republican.
Brad is a conservative Republican, but he decided he was interested enough to see what this Michael Moore guy was all about since he was coming to town. So anyway, I was handing out your cards, and I had to pause for air. My rubber mask was dreadfully hot, and I pulled it off, and I breathed, and everybody looked at me because they wanted to see who Bush really was. And Brad saw that I was female, and he looked down at the card in his hand that I had just given him, and he saw that it had to do with your website, and he already knew you because you'll remember that he put up his own website, which is now a gigantic 9/11 website, question911.com, and he had put up two 9/11 movies on that website, Dave Von Kleist's In Plain Sight and your Painful Deception. So he knew who you were, and he saw this little card that this Bush character was handing out, and he couldn't believe it. It was a coincidence. So then when he got home, he emailed you and asked you who this woman was that was dressed as Bush passing out cards through your website. And you told him that it was someone who lived in the same town that he lived in. And so you put us together. And Brad and I brainstormed night after night after night about 9/11. We were quite amazed at public resistance to this topic. They didn't want to know much, if anything. And so over the months, we put together a little presentation, which actually wasn't little. It was about 6 hours long, and we did it in a conference room at a law firm that I had a friend be kind enough to let us use. And 20 people came. I invited the most thinking people I could dig up, lawyers. Not that lawyers think, but anyway, we'll leave the lawyer jokes for later. People who had run for Congress, I invited an MIT engineer, an oil industry consultant, and then a few regular people who were just very smart. I wanted to see what the resistance would be to this information. And we had 6 hours of video evidence, even taken from documentaries. We just showed documentaries to these people, segments of them. And then we gave a little bit of running commentary. And at the end, we discovered there was no resistance. They were all sitting there around this conference table. Their jaws had basically dropped into their laps. And they just said, what can we do? What do we do with all this? And a friend of mine had come down from L.A., and he saw this as well. And he told me, you've got to cut this down into 2 hours and take it on the road, and I'll get you bookings in L.A. So he took us up to L.A., and we did this at a few churches, and at first the turnout was very, very scanty. And then we had an interview on KPFK, and that is the Pacifica station. And it was remarkable. We got, I think, something like 150 people to our Pasadena event, which was May 1st of last year, and that produced an invitation from somebody in the theater business. He wanted us to do this weekly at a theater in L.A. because he felt people should know that it was going to happen. They should know where to tell people to go. It couldn't be done scattergun, once here, once there, 6 weeks later, someplace else. So we did get an invitation from the Met Theater, which is a progressive little theater. It's been doing amazing works, many of them political, for some 20 or 30 years. And we did this show. It wasn't a drama. This is not a play. We did our presentation, and you were a guest, I think, once to the Met Theater and a couple of times to some of our other events. And it was a collection of video evidence presented in the darkness of the theater with live narration by Brad and myself. And we had it in four sections, Demolition, Hijackers and Planes, War Games, and Who Benefits. And by the time we were doing Who Benefits, when you tied everything together, the Iraq War and the Patriot Act and the stock trade, people were quite blown away. And we decided to make a DVD out of this because taking it farther than L.A. was a little bit difficult logistically. So anyway, I have talked up a storm.
Yeah, I had forgotten how you and Brad met. So
because of you, Eric.
You reminded me. I'd forgotten about that. And so it was in the summer of 2005 that you were doing those shows at the Met Theater,
right,
I guess.
Last year.
And you did about, what was it, half a dozen?
Six, yes.
Yeah, because I remember going to one of them at least.
And it was very hot that day, and you wore your black Undertaker suit.
Well, my suit, yeah. Yeah, so it was in the summer of 2005 you were doing the shows, and then you decided to start working on the DVD a few months later, I guess.
Well, just about at the end of the summer, because our choice was to keep doing the show and to keep driving to L.A. every weekend, and it was a bit of an ordeal. It took a whole day to drive up and set up, do the show, then go out to dinner with all the people who wanted to go out to dinner with us, which was always very nice, but it was a whole day. So I decided, Brad was very busy doing his normal work, and it fell upon me to create the movie. So I didn't really know what I was getting into, and I just thought, oh, this will be easy. We'll just use the clips that we have, and I'll narrate, and that'll be that.
Yeah, I remember that part where you were saying, thinking it would be easy, you'd be done in a couple months.
Well, that's what the first video editor that we hired quoted. He said he could do it in 3 weeks. But in 3 weeks, he kind of walked off the job. So
it ended up taking more like a year, if I remember correctly, didn't
it? Well, actually, when I started, I found that so many people were interested to contribute research to us, including you and others who had seen the show. Everyone seems to have their private trove of 9/11 discovery. So I received gifts of many videotapes and magazines and books, and I was asked to consider everything and put together the movie from this enormous bank of material. And as I started assembling the movie, now I have written professionally, so I understood that the writing of this would be crucial, and having written a couple of novels and a few screenplays and done a lot of book. I was a book doctor, which meant that I analyzed people's manuscripts and prepared them for marketability, the market, literary representation and publishing. So I had a good eye for what made a piece of writing work, and therefore when I entered this movie-making endeavor, I knew that I had to have a very well-constructed script that had to have almost like a narrative arc to it, a story arc, because most of the 9/11 movies were clusters of clips, and they didn't really cohere in an artistic way. So my challenge was to try to do that with the material, and I didn't know that I would be able to, but it seems that that's been the result from the way people have responded. So I guess I was lucky, and I don't know.
Well, you also put a lot of time and effort into it, didn't you? What was it? Wasn't it about a year?
Yes. Well, actually, I started doing the actual building of the timeline in January, and it was going to be for the whole movie, and the whole movie was designed to be something like 2 hours, I mean, in my wildest dreams. And then I realized, as I was doing the demolition section itself, that alone was going to be huge. So in April, I had the brainwave of releasing 9/11 Mysteries Part 1 Demolitions and giving all you demolition, you know, maniacs your own huge feature-length movie. It would be a movie about the demolitions of 9/11, which in many ways is, you could even say, the safest angle or aspect of the whole picture, because it's the cleanest, it involves laws of science.
Yeah, it's difficult to argue with it.
Right. And the terrain of the Pentagon and the hijackers and whether planes hit the towers or mirages hit them, or I'm just using that word very loosely. I beg forgiveness from anyone.
Right. Well, and then...
But anyway, sorry.
Oh, and then you also, I saw, for people who have never gone through making a video, I was just going to point out, you even had to go through several video editors before you found one that could even do the job.
Yes. I did use rather more basic editors to do assembly with me, and then I took the project to someone who was much more skilled and much more expensive, but enormously talented. And he was a mainstreamer, and that was another bonus that I didn't really appreciate until a little bit later, because if something didn't make sense to him, we just worked on the movie from A to Z. It was written. He would go piece by piece with me. We would sit down. We'd spend whatever it was, a week, doing a section. And he wouldn't know what was coming later. And so each section was a brand new aspect of 9/11 that he really didn't know anything about. So as I would explain it to him first, and then we actually started working on it, I would grill him for whether or not it made sense to him. And he was very honest, and he's very logical, and he's also very artistic, so he's a good mix of two very important things. I guess you could call them left and right brain. And he would just tell me if something didn't make sense, I would then simplify it or clarify it.
So he was like a test case.
Yes, he was.
And then when you released it, it was September, wasn't it?
By the skin of my teeth, whatever that means, I managed to get the thing out by September 11th because, you know, if you're going to release it, have any kind of big celebration of a release date, it would be that.
And it was all, when you say he was expensive, you were not, you were doing this with borrowed money then, weren't you? You were, you're not independently wealthy or getting donations or anything.
No, the donations were, they trickled in, but they were very small. And I thank every single person who gave me a donation. I actually wrote thank you notes to the people who gave donations.
You mean during the creation of it, you were getting donations?
A little bit. I had, you know, something up on the website. We called it sponsorship. If you want to sponsor 9/11 Mysteries, most of them are about $25. But it was still everything. It's the intention, you know. And I wish that there had been people with very deep pockets who would write gigantic checks, but or who would have written gigantic checks. But that didn't happen. And so I really had to resort to credit cards, and tapped my house as well.
With a mortgage, a second mortgage, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
So now that you've got it out, you've got it both on the Internet now for free, and people can buy the DVD. What sort of reaction have you been getting from people? Is it what you were expecting? Are you at all surprised in any way?
Well, I'm a little surprised because it's largely a very emotional reaction. People have reported to me. I get emails consistently, and a lot of people say they have been moved to tears, and they are gripped by the movie in a way that really I have never intended. It was, I think, the net effect of the music, and I think the stuff I put at the end really kind of grabs people. There's a great sadness to the end of the movie, and that hits home in a way that a lot of our work in 9/11 hasn't managed to do. And Brad had urged me to keep in mind the emotional content of what I was doing. And I don't know if you can really manipulate it successfully until you've tried and you've tested it, but he pointed out that the official videos and all those programs, we certainly got a barrage of them this past month of September, that they really yank your emotions. It's all constructed on sentimentality. And you're supposed to be very, you know, sad about the people that died, which is, of course, warranted. But that should not mask inquiry into the details and the hows and the whys and the whos of all this. It doesn't, just because a tragedy happened doesn't mean we shouldn't look into it. So I think the glaring mistake that the world has made is that they have decided to move on. The masses at large, you know, move on. Let's just, 9/11 is over. Let's look toward the future.
And what about people like you were saying, Ray McGovern has even been there to show the film. Is that what he was doing, showing it to somebody and showing it to a group in Florida?
I don't think it's fair to say that Ray McGovern showed the film, but he was invited to a screening of the film.
Oh, invited to see it.
Yes, and he was going to say a few words to introduce it, and I had actually sent him a copy of the movie beforehand. But as it turned out, he was doing an interview at the very same time the movie was beginning. So somebody else introduced it, and then he came in and watched the rest of it. And he did say some words at the end.
Have you heard how he felt about it yet?
I was told by people who were there that, I think he said, "I am speechless." I that's what I think they emailed me.
Well, do you know if it's getting to other people who are sort of prominent in this whole so-called truth movement? That
prominent in the truth?
Well, like Ray McGovern. See, a lot of people are saying, you know, they don't really know yet what happened. You know, if you look at even people in Air America or on Bill O'Reilly, you know, a lot of these people will make it appear as if they don't really know what's going on. I was wondering if you know that, have these people actually seen the movie? Because, you know, now Ray McGovern has seen it. He can't say he hasn't.
Right.
See, when they come out in public and someone asks them about 9/11, their typical excuse is, "Well, I haven't really looked into it."
Well, several people have asked me to give them a copy to give directly to Amy Goodman. Well, maybe I shouldn't say several. I think it's two people, and I autographed one for her. I wrote "For Amy from Sophia" on the disc. So I hope that made it to her.
No, but you have no idea, though.
I have no idea, no.
Well, what about, have you heard anything? In your movie, you do mention Building 7. One of the unusual things about it, you know, what was inside of it, the cases like Enron and evidence for other crimes. Have you gotten any feedback on that, any more information or any reaction to that? Because that, if you look at what somebody else is saying, the CEO of Overstock.com is saying, what we see with Enron, he says, is only the tip of the iceberg, that there is a much, much bigger scandal going on with the stock markets and even with Enron than what we see. And I was wondering, have you heard anything since your movie came out? Has anybody offered you any more information or anything about this Building 7 or Enron or what the SEC cases were inside that building or anything?
Well, I've only been made aware of an article that's on the Eighth Estate website.
Eighth Estate?
Maza, yes. It's Richard Grove's website. So I did read that article. But it wasn't conclusive in terms of, you know, which cases exactly. And I don't know if anyone has that information.
So nobody's come forward with anything since your movie's been out then? Because well, that would be a useful thing if people did know to bring that forward.
Right. And I think whoever is, whoever said it's the tip of the iceberg is right. There's, I mean, we're really seeing the tip of the iceberg on every subject. We have been deluded into thinking that the world is this, you know, little rose garden, and it isn't. And that's what I think people have to be comforted about, almost, that if you proceed with dread and fear about all this, then you almost diminish your own capability of doing much about it. Because I do think that fear and dread are very paralyzing, and they kind of feed more of the same, if you know what I mean.
Well, yeah.
I find this inspiring. It's strange to say that, but I do.
And you mean to look into 9/11 and the corruption and what's all behind it?
Yes. I was interviewed by the Tampa Tribune, which is it's the main newspaper of Tampa, Florida, a couple of days ago, and I told the reporter that when you look into 9/11 or anything, JFK, vaccinations, chemtrails, anything, as you start looking into it, and you read more and more and more and more, you start, number one, you'll start having intuitive leaps of your own, and then you'll find that your leaps are backed up by what you're reading. And so everything starts knitting together. And you'll also find, number two, that what you read, it correlates with everything else that you're reading. And the knitting together of this only makes it all the more believable. Because I told this reporter, if it is fiction, if all this is made up, all this stuff is just pure conspiracy theory drivel that people are cooking up because they have nothing better to do, then the more you go into it, the more it will fall apart. But instead, it's the opposite. The more you go into it, the more it coheres. And that, to me, is totally fascinating.
Well, yeah, you're uncovering a mystery is what you're doing. You're not uncovering a fantasy.
Well, the mystery is, well, you're uncovering a picture. It's almost as though you're in the dark room. I used to be a dark room, a black and white photo developer. And I just used to be in awe as you exposed the print and you could see it.
Oh, watching it come forward,
yeah.
Right. I guess that's what you're doing. It's like watching a print come out as you dig into it and see who's behind it all.
Yeah, and then you start seeing the details. And then, of course, in photography, you have to stop it at a certain point. And then you fix it. But in this case, you can't stop it. It's just, it's very engrossing.
So instead of becoming frightened by this, you're finding it fascinating.
It's totally fascinating. And it's freeing. Because really, the delusions that you've carried all this time without really knowing that that's what they were are being cleaned away. And now you get to redefine the world. And I think as people go through life, they become more cynical. I know that I was. I was becoming more bitter, more cynical, more irritated with the way things were. Because I think deep down, we sense that they're not.
Something's wrong.
Great.
Yeah,
there's something wrong. Or there's something false. And I now have gone into the rabbit hole and gone to the other side, gone through what I call the keyhole into consciousness, it begins to redefine itself. Now you can start all over again. You can literally remake the world in its more realistic definitions. And you know your coordinates. You know your north and south and east and west much more clearly.
Well, you know, that's interesting because when I was a teenager, I made a decision that when I leave home, I'm never going to get a TV or buy newspapers or magazines. And to me, it was because they just seemed stupid and I couldn't bring myself to doing it. But now that I see 9/11 and all the rest of it, it's making more sense. It's not that they're stupid. It's that they are deliberately deceptive. On purpose.
Right.
It's by design that it's this way, that they're deliberately covering up a lot of issues. They're deliberately bringing out irrelevant issues to distract and entertain and create trouble. And see, it actually makes more sense now. Rather than just looking at the world, like you said, with cynicism and thinking, oh, these stupid TV shows, now it starts to make sense. This is why they bring out these crazy issues all the time. You know, like during an election, they'll throw out abortion and get all the Republicans fighting with each other, and then they'll bring up cutting Social Security or welfare and get the Democrats fighting, and you think, why are they doing this? It's because of an attempt to keep the people fighting confused while they take over.
Well, that's right. And to distract us and absorb our energy. I mean, we only have so much energy in the day. And really, I think that living is an exercise in choosing how to spend your time and where to put your mind and what to be aware of. And I was telling, I shouldn't give away my whole interview to the Tampa Tribune, but whatever. I told this reporter that our day in America is taken up with the making of possibly even hundreds of irrelevant decisions. Like, should I switch from Singular to Verizon or to Sprint? Or should I shop at Albertsons or the A&P or Ralph's or Vaughn's or where? Or, you know, which magazine should I buy from this newsstand? And all the magazines are the same. They're all derivatives of one another. So really and truly, there is no real importance to the decisions we're making. They're simply time-consuming. And because we have such an array of choices at our fingertips every minute of the day, we waste our time and energy making these decisions. And therefore, we don't have the time and energy to think of much else.
Right. Well, your message would actually be something we should all be telling people, to be enjoying this uncovering of the mystery rather than what you see right now, which is fear them. Fear that they're going to put chips in you. Fear that they're going to track and trace you. Fear that you can't do anything about it. If your attitude that you're enjoying it, that should get out. Have you ever been at all worried when you were doing this that you might get killed by these people? Did that ever bother you at any point during this whole creation of your DVD or doing the shows in Hollywood?
Killed?
Yeah.
I don't think I was worried about being killed, but I was worried about having my project tampered with or
sabotaged,
arrested. Yes. Not me being arrested, but the project. That, you know, somehow the hard drives would disappear, or, you know, I would have a setback and I would have to start again. And that was a concern. So,
but overall, the fascination with uncovering it overrode any sort of worries.
Well, I had a blast, pardon the pun, making this demolition section. I'm a girl, remember? I don't like explosions and guns and all that stuff. I have my own theories as to why men are fascinated with explosions, but I'll leave that for
another time.
A follow-up interview. Anyway, no, I'm a girl, so I don't like that stuff, and I had to delve into it, and it was not comfortable for me, really, until I got past a certain point and I started to really think, and I started to compare what I was learning about blasting, the world of blasting, with reports that witnesses had made of what they heard and saw at the Twin Towers, or rather the World Trade Center. And the correlations were abundantly clear. That there was a sequence to blasting, to bringing down a building. It was done in stages that followed in quick succession, but it involved different kinds of explosions, and the same kinds of explosions were reported at the World Trade Center. So that caused me to create what I call my six-stage demolition theory. and it became kind of the centerpiece of the video. And then it was followed by a lot of new material that I unearthed by sheer luck when I talked to Scott Forbes, and he decided to tell me everything that he could remember that was weird prior to September 11th.
And how did you get a hold of Scott Forbes?
His letter to John Kaminsky was actually available on the internet, and I emailed him.
You just through email?
Yes. And then
he's in England, isn't he?
Yes, now he's in England.
And at the time, of course, he was working in, living in New Jersey?
Yes, he lived across the Hudson in New Jersey, and he had taken the day off because the power down of the weekend before 9/11 had been such a nightmare for Fiduciary Trust, as their servers were on the premises. You see, this is one thing that a lot of 9/11 people even are a little worried about. Why did no one else report the power down? And therefore they think because it was this singular experience of Scott Forbes that it is too isolated to pay attention to. But in fact, what Scott pointed out to me in the interview was most of the offices or the companies in the Twin Towers did not have servers on the premises. Their servers were located elsewhere. So when they shut their computers off on Friday night, the power down didn't affect their systems at all because they would come in on Monday morning and fire the computers up and everything would be just hunky-dory. But for Scott's company with a server right there at the World Trade Center or in the whatever South Tower they were, it wasn't going to be easy. They actually lost data as a result of the power down. And then they really lost it, I guess, because the building collapsed. But he did say that he had to spend all of Monday working to the wee hours of Monday night, Tuesday morning, and
trying to get back the data,
to get everything working again, working normally, and that there had been this notification 3 weeks prior by the Port Authority, a memo, which nobody has any longer, but it would have been great to have that memo. And they said, we're going to shut the power off, and it presented enormous problems for certain companies. So that's why the power down was of such a magnitude to Scott not to anyone else.
But if he knew it was coming weeks in advance, how did they get caught off guard?
What do you mean caught off
guard? Well, I mean, how would they lose data if they knew it was coming?
Well, there were certain... He said inevitably they could not preserve their entire system with the power down. I don't know. You'll have to ask.
Oh, but he did save some of it then.
No, I think everything was, not everything, mostly everything was restored, but there was some that was not restored. It was a complete power down. So, anyway, he did take the day off on Tuesday, and he slept late and was awakened by what he thought was a truck going over a bump in the road below him, because it was a boom, boom, boom kind of a sound, and he thought it was a big, huge truck, and he got up, and he looked out the window, and the road was empty, and then he looked around, and he saw the North Tower hit first?
Yes.
The North Tower smoking, and I guess maybe he even caught the fireball, and then he realized what had happened. And so, interestingly, the multiple booms he heard might have been the first plane strike, and then the fireball would have been the second one. But I think he said there were three boom sounds very close together. And that could have been one of the underground explosions. But so he continued to watch, and that's when he witnessed the plane hitting the South Tower a little bit later. And he does say that this was definitely a plane, that it was not anything but a plane. And he had seen planes flying, you know, from, there are various airports around Manhattan. There's Kennedy, LaGuardia, Newark, and he had seen planes of all shapes and sizes as long as he had lived in New Jersey.
So he's not going for this no plane hologram or blue screen nonsense.
He feels very strongly that there was definitely a plane that hit the South Tower, and he saw it full on.
Well, what do you think about the issue of all the deception in this movement? Do you even pay much attention to those accusations, that, or do you pretty much trust everybody out there?
The deception in the movement,
as it
originates from the government?
Well, like, my opinion is most of the people that are trying to expose 9/11 are not really trying to expose it at all. They're trying to control it. They're trying to create fear. They're not trying to help us at all. Do you at all look at those issues, or is that something you haven't really paid much attention to?
Well, I'm aware of those issues because I talked to you.
Well,
there are other people who have tried to alert me to the fact that, you know, there are many wolves in sheep's clothing out there.
But do you find the issue confusing still, or is it
no,
something?
No, I would say that I go by my gut, and I might be, you know, very naive, but I do believe that a lot of people are driven by a desire to do something about this. And what you're seeing them do is what they are capable of doing. And it is confusing, I will say, because everybody has their own brand of discussion, attitude, behavior even. And people tend to squabble. I think it's the human tendency, inclination. You put kids in the schoolyard and that's what they'll do. So I think that's what we're seeing. I don't feel that it's as
deliberate as I do.
Make it out to be. But then again, you've been in it longer, and I'm really, you know, a babe in the wood.
And when did you first learn about 9/11? Because you said it was 2004 when you were creating the cards in the Flash movie, but is that when you first learned about it too? I can't remember.
Yes. I remember, though, when it happened, my mother told me that day. I had talked to her on the phone after the planes had struck the towers, and then she told me, and one of the buildings just collapsed. And I just said, it was an explosive utterance. I said, that's ridiculous. And it just seemed to me, because I had lived in New York and I knew what the Twin Towers were, that they couldn't just fall down.
It's funny, because when my mom called me and said the towers fell down, I said, oh, they couldn't have fallen down.
No.
I said the same thing.
But the fact is they did. And so I just shunned the whole, all that brouhaha and the, you know, fanfare and the sentiment and all that stuff on TV. I wouldn't watch TV. In fact, people told me that day to turn my TV on, and I wouldn't. I was ill that day. I had violent stomach pain, and to this day I don't know why. Maybe it was a premonitory thing, you know, and a friend of mine made a joke about it. He said, next time you have stomach pain, call the feds. Something's about to happen, but...
Anyway, but you ignored it all on TV then.
I would not watch TV. I just did not want to be part of this. I knew it was going to be a dog and pony show.
Well, you don't watch much TV anyway, do you?
Now I do, for analysis and pure enjoyment.
But at the time?
Well, of discovering. You know, it's an observation of the Matrix and not the Matrix. So when you are out of it, and you are alert and out of it, it's very interesting to go back into it and experience it.
So now you watch TV, I guess, like I do, to see what are they saying to deceive people with, and how are they deceiving?
Well, the logic, especially in advertising, I do remember an ad, and I kid you not, I was not dreaming. I was sitting in front of the television, and there was an ad on, and it was a woman in her 40s, and she was running through a meadow with her hair blowing in the wind and all the little wildflowers around her, and she said, I take, I don't know, some kind of big, huge, convoluted medical name, laxative. I take blah, 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 laxative. And she said, it's absolutely wonderful. It keeps me regular, and I can eat all the junk food I want.
That's what she said?
That was an ad on television.
Oh.
Lifetime, Channel 26.
So she can eat all the junk food
yep,
she wants?
I take blah, 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 laxative, and it keeps me regular, and I can eat all the junk food I want. I was lucky I was sitting on the floor, because I would have fallen to the floor, probably. So that's the logic they're delivering.
Well, now that you know all of this about 9/11 and the deception, when you watch TV, what is the message that you're picking up? I mean, what do you see as the TV, what do you see them doing? Do you see a message coming out of it?
Yes, they're whipping our emotions around. I had to turn a channel just now when I was going to watch a wonderful DVD on vaccines, and I logged in, as I'm used to saying, for the computer, and there was some fat guy on some news station telling us what the Democrats are trying to get us to believe. And it was so confusing, it made my brain hurt. So I had to turn it off.
That was regular television, right?
Yes. No, no, I think it was the cable channel. I don't even know what it was. I didn't want to find out. It was a painful experience, even though it was very brief. It makes your head hurt, and they want you to take sides, and they are jerking you around, and if that's what you want in your life, then, you know, that's great. But unfortunately, somebody told me that human beings are more easily trained than the dog, okay? And just think about it. If you're training a dog to sit, you have to press on his back end, and you have to say, sit, 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 and press really hard on his hindquarters. And eventually he will let his legs give way because he realizes you really want him to do this. And you really like it if he does that. And then he gets a treat. And human beings, we have language at our disposal. So all you have to do is tell a person, those buildings fell because the steel was weak. And they go, oh, okay.
And then reward them with something. Like you're with the crowd. You're now with the... You're not one of those conspiracy nuts and, you know, make them feel good.
We're all human and we make mistakes. And even those engineers who built those buildings, they made a terrible mistake. And as I say in the video, they built the building to take the impact of a jet plane, but they forgot to take into account the fuel.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that I've noticed is when you look at who can deal with 9/11 and who can't, it has nothing to do with intelligence. It's more of a personality, and that may be, it may be the ones that are not so easily swayed by those, you know, that are more independent. That's what it seems to me. Is that what you're finding, or haven't you thought much about who can?
No, of course I've thought about who likes this and who doesn't, and...
And what have you noticed? Have you noticed any patterns and who can deal with it?
Well, I find that people with children are the most resistant to accepting that something really bad is going on. And it's ongoing. It wasn't isolated. It's not like it happened on September 11th. So I think people with small children are the most resistant. People with grown children, they're often trying to convert their children, and since kids will go in the opposite direction of their parents, if the parents are aware of 9/11, chances are good that the kids, the grown kids, don't want to believe it.
Is that what you're finding?
Yes, yes, I am. And then, of course, people without children have an easier time because they don't have to deal with the pain and fear that they've brought other beings into this world. So I think it's best accomplished, though, by invitation, that we invite people to consider this, and later, after they've given it some thought, to agree that it had to have happened by laws of science and not myth. And that creates unity, and unity is best created by invitation, not by confrontation and accusation or ridicule.
And what sort of reaction have you been getting from the people who, you know, have been buying more than one of these copies that, and, you know, to distribute it? Have they been getting at least, are they seeing more of a change now? Because it was really tough, you know, in 2002, 2003. I suppose you weren't involved at all then, but what have you been getting much of a reaction? Because you said somebody, the people up in Seattle, even the teenage girls were even singing along with the music.
I don't think it was teenagers, Eric. These were adults, full-grown adults. Yes, there is...
Adults?
There is a 9/11 group in Seattle, and the group has been actively showing 9/11 mysteries, and a friend of mine was invited to attend one of their screenings and say a few words because she knows me. And she was a little bit aghast because the whole way through the movie, the Seattle group had memorized the lines, my narration, and were quoting along with me, narrating along with me. And then when the music came, particularly some of the classical parts, they were singing, hitting all the high notes in the Carmen piece. Habanera, and also conducting with their hands.
How big of a group was this? Do you know?
She didn't really say. She said, I don't know, I think it was about 40 or so, maybe, and she said there were newcomers there, and the newcomers were a little bit annoyed because they were having a hard time absorbing the movie with all this distraction going on.
Oh, so it has been getting some
Yes, good. I get emails from people who say they've watched it 5 times, 10 times. They're making notes. They're really trying to isolate the different angles and arguments, because everybody, I think, will develop their own way of broaching the subject with a stranger or a friend. I think one encounters the most difficulty trying to get this across to friends. I know that people who know me are more uncomfortable hearing about it than people who don't know me.
Oh, what about the Google video? When you first put that on, me and even Daryl Smith had noticed the numbers kept dropping. You know, the views, it would keep track of how many people viewed it. So, you know, it was like 17,000 one day, 27,000 the next, and drops down to 17,000 the next day.
We actually followed it a little bit, it would go up to, like, it would be 19,000 or so at the end of the day, and then the next morning it would be down at 600. So I think they were resetting the counters.
Was this, who, were you and Brad both watching this?
I, of course, don't do much internet hawking, but... Brad was, and
what did he say? Was it only Google Video, or is that the only place you have it?
No, it's on his site, and I know there are links to it from many, many sites, but I think primarily it's on Google, and there might be two versions on Google, I'm not sure.
But he saw, he was watching Google resetting it over and over.
Well, they reset it, or let's just say it appears that they reset it a couple of times at least.
How has his traffic been for the video? Has he told you yet? Has he been getting?
Oh, he gets a healthy amount of traffic, and he finds that his heaviest traffic is during lunch hour when people are sitting at their desks, scarfing down their whatever it is, piles of Chinese food.
So it's at lunch hour when he gets...
Yeah, in offices, and they're watching videos.
Hey, but
he puts up, I think he has about 30 documentaries, and they're not all 9/11 by any means. He's got one I think he's got one called Stupidity, which is an analysis of the pretend or the popularity of stupidity versus intelligence in our culture. So he's got lots of videos up there and all subjects. And so people really receive an education.
And he's getting most at lunch hour. But lunch hour for who? The United States?
Yeah, I mean, lunch hour is, I suppose you could say, 3 to 5 hours, isn't it? If you take into account all the time.
Does he have any idea how many people might have watched it? Any rough estimates?
9/11 mystery?
Yeah.
I haven't asked him.
Oh.
I think once he told me it was like 30,000 on his site, and it was a few weeks ago, so.
So it could well be into the.
Over 500,000 now, without counting the reset.
So it could be, it could be into the 500,000 or more by now.
Well, it's already more than 500,000.
Oh.
But if you add on maybe another, I don't know, 50,000 or something, it's a small number, but it's getting up there. The resets are a small number, but.
Oh, and so now, do you have any more upcoming interviews or any big things that are coming up? Anything from this that you're aware of or that you can talk about?
Well, there's been interest from a couple of TV stations, but not in this country. A lot of desire to translate. I've had inquiries from people in Turkey and China and, gosh, any number of people in the Western European countries, then some of the Slavic countries and...
So it's getting out there then.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a success. So hopefully this 9/11 will finally come out. This has been going on for so long, it's almost getting on my nerves. I don't know about you, but it's been 6 years.
You've been in it a long time, Eric, and you were the reason. You had asked me to explain how I got into it, and watching your video, which I must admit, I received a copy of Global Outlook, and I think it was January of 2004. And I was reading Global Outlook, and I read a synopsis. It was more like an advertisement for your book and your video. And I was very taken with the points made. It was a very good write-up. Ian Woods of Global Outlook probably put it together. And I remember sitting there and saying, especially when I read the point made about the fact that the steel had been severed in lengths, more or less uniform lengths, that fit the trucks that carted it off, and that this was one of the methods used in controlled demolitions of buildings, that they would fit the debris to make it easy to clean up. So when I read that, I just went, oh, gosh, that's definitely telling. And then I looked at the price. It was $19.99 for the video, and I thought, no, that's too much. What if it's bad? I'll have wasted $20. So I have to tell you, Eric, I was too cheap.
Well, then how did you get it? How did you see it?
Well, it goes back to Michael Moore. I actually went to a rally, a peace rally, and I noticed 6 guys dressed in Bush flight suits with Bush masks, and they were hilarious. They were graduate students from the local university, and I spoke to one of them, and he's the one who turned me on to my Bush outfit, and I ended up getting to know him, and he had a gigantic file cabinet full of videos and books. And he lent me your book and your video, and I took the stuff home, and I watched the video that night, and his mother had obtained the material from you directly, so I asked for your number. And so I met you because of Bush.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, and then you met Brad, and then you put together the shows, and then the video, and now who knows where it's going to go?
Who knows? I know. I have 2 more videos.
And are you going to tell us ahead of time what's coming up in them, or is it going
to
be...
Well, Hijackers and Planes, you know, I have to, like, step into the swamp of all that stuff. and try to do a decent job of hashing through it so that I don't get seared by criticism and invite my own early downfall.
Oh. And then the other one was what?
I'm going to combine the war games section with hijackers and planes because it really also has to do with planes, the whole air defense thing.
And then the who benefits.
Who benefits. And who benefits is really all about secrecy. You know, the first video is about myth. The second one is probably going to be about illusion and deception. And the third is secrecy. And when you travel into the heart of this, you are, first of all, it's more indistinct than anything else, probably, the identities of these people and who they are and whether they're operating as people or entities or...
Well, there's also more deception involved in that because they want to protect themselves.
Right. The secrecy. I would use the word secrecy rather than deception because secrecy has always ruled the world.
Yes. Well, secrecy, but then the deception is to throw you off the people off course that are looking.
Right.
That's what they do for people who are looking at. Because that's where you'll get all the different theories that are sending you in the wrong path. And it's not for the general public, it's for the investigators. If you start looking into it, they try to send you in the wrong direction.
Yes, but this is where I think people have to rely on their own instinct. More than their mind. I don't know. That's what I do.
Oh.
But, what? You know, I haven't gone very deep.
You're still doing that one.
I'm still trying to get informed. I don't know if I'll ever know enough to do the third video.
Oh. So. Well, you'll find out, I suppose. You're going to first try to make your money back on this one, I suppose, before you even... tackle the others.
It's not even about money anymore. Money is just this ancillary thing that is unfortunately required to make things happen in our world, but the real impulse or impetus in me is curiosity and the ability to start putting it together in a way that develops its own life. And that's really what storytelling is about. The story has a life of its own, and as soon as you figure out its nature or its identity, it will live itself. You simply are the fingers typing. You are literally just a mule in a harness, and the story is the director of itself. And I think as a writer, that's what I've always waited for. And it doesn't always happen. It doesn't happen for every project. But you have to work with the project till you can get it to, like, unfold and have its own zen. And then it just does it itself. And you know it's going to happen.
Yeah, well,
money really isn't what it's about.
Well, let's hope we can get more people to have that attitude of, the fascination for it rather than this fear or this trying to hide from it. If we could get, if that comes out of this from, you know, that would really help, I think, a lot if they could pick up that attitude of yours that don't be afraid, be curious, be fascinated, enjoy it.
Well, it is. It's exhilarating, especially when you start to make your own discoveries. And then you call people up and you go, guess what I discovered? And you brainstorm and you realize, well, that there may be something to that, or maybe it's really part of something else. I mean, I had a thought just the other night, and I want to start using this word, but not in a critical way, just kind of as an observation. The people that prefer not to know about this are enablers. They are 9/11 enablers because they won't make it possible for more of this to happen.
Enablers. Huh?
Yes. So when I came upon that, I thought, oh, well, maybe we can explain to them that you are really effectively an enabler of this. If you choose to ignore it or drive your kids to soccer and let me do the work. Because I have had people say that to me. They have patted me on the back and said, good, good, good girl. Go for it. You do it because I really have too much to do in my life. So you figure it out. You make the movie. You get up there. You stand in the line of fire. And I'll just be in the background knowing that you're doing this for me.
Yeah, well, if we could get more people to be enjoying it. See, that's what I think we're not getting out of school is, you know, the enjoyment of learning, thinking, discovering. We don't have that right now. We have more learn and don't think, accept without question.
I'd like to say something about school because I figured this out a few years ago. And not that everything I figure out is right, but anyway, learning, acquiring knowledge is not linear. It is actually spatial. It's abstract, meaning that in order to make a leap, your mind has to be able to hold many disparate pieces of information at one time. And that doesn't feel good. It's hard to do. And as you hold onto these bits, suddenly you will make a leap and the bits will all come together. And that is really gleaning something or gaining knowledge. And what has happened in the school systems is they have boiled learning down into a very linear, very boring process. And they have, in order not to make students feel discomfort while they learn, they have so oversimplified it that the process of learning itself is rote and boring. For instance, if you are illiterate and I teach you the alphabet, A, B, C, D, F, G, up till the last letter, all 26 of them, I can teach you that A, the letter A, is the sound A, and the letter C is the sound K, and the letter T is the shape that it is in the sound K. And then I will just have to wait until the day comes that you put those bits together and you see that that animal walking across the room, the K, A, T, is those marks that you have made on the paper. I cannot teach you that. I have to wait until you get that. And that's the spatial leap. And what happens in our schools is that they make everything very linear. And so people have lost the ability and the interest in making these leaps, in living with the discomfort of gaining knowledge until such time as it formulates in their mind. And the leap and the inspiration and all the attendant euphoric things occur. We just don't have that.
Well, like memorizing information rather than learning how to.
Yes, and the standardized tests and the multiple choice.
Well, that's what it is. It's memorizing.
It is. It's become rote, and it's really to prevent the experience of learning. It's to prevent the person from having an uncomfortable experience of learning.
Well, I also think, because I noticed this when I was in high school with history, you just memorize things, but what's the point? What's the point of learning history if you don't learn from it? And I think one of the reasons they're doing that is they don't want you to look at history, because if you start looking at it, and that's when you realize some of our history is a lie.
Most of it is. The victors write it.
Well, whether it's, yeah, most or some, but the point is they don't want you to look at history and ask questions like, what, you know, what's the point of learning this? What, because learning, memorizing history doesn't do you any good. Memorizing what happened on September 11th, 2001 doesn't do you any good. If you don't learn from it, what's the point of just memorizing this stuff? But that's what they seem to be doing in school, and that might be one of their plans. And what they should do is pick up your attitude, like enjoy learning about 9/11. Don't be afraid. Enjoy it. Enjoy the discovery, like you're out on an Easter egg hunt as a child or something. you're finding little clues as you go along.
Well, enjoy. Shall we have a bumper sticker, enjoy 9/11?
Yes.
And we'll put learning about in very small letters between the two words.
Well, that's right. That's what it should be. But you're not, see, this is what I don't see with these so-called 9/11 investigators. They are not encouraging discussions or thinking or anything. They're encouraging fear. Even Aaron Russo's movie, Freedom to Fascism, has pictures of the little chips they're going to put under your skin. You know, it's almost frightening. When you look at what he's doing, it's not information to think about. It's a little information and then a lot of fear.
Well, actually, his movie contains a lot of information. But you're right, it could be inspiring fear. Most of us we've grown up in a culture of fear. The religion does that to us, and authority does that, and it's something that's pretty hardwired into us. It's a very, it's from the reptilian brain. So the experience of being human calls for transcending all of our biology, doesn't it? So in order to dispel fear, whether it's your own or in others, you have to do something transcendent.
Well, I guess we could end with that message. Enjoy 9/11. Enjoy it. Enjoy thinking about it. Enjoy it like a mystery that you're solving. And
that's right.
Don't be afraid. And let's try to learn from it, make the world better, and hopefully counteract this fear that's out there.
I would say be inspired. There is nothing more wonderful than becoming inspired.
And be inspiring to the others.
Yes.
Thanks for being on tonight.
Thank you so much, Eric, and Daryl also. I still want to know what I am the witness means.
I think he explained it once as he wants to witness the end of all this or something. But
he wants to witness the Armageddon. He wants
to
feed in the river of blood.
No. The end of 9/11 and you know. I think that's what he means. But we'll talk to him about that sometime.
All right.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye.